nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so as you remember, what you had been talking about the last few days has been this relationship between this one electron picture, which we normally use, which is what you'll see most of the course. Most of the time we'll be using, talking in terms of this one electron levels. And what is that? Well, it's like you have energy levels into which electrons can come in or go out. And then there is this multi-electron picture, which is more comprehensive, et cetera, but it's not as convenient to use. And in general, we won't be using it much. But there are lots of things in this one-electron picture that make a little more sense when you, if you have this multi-electron picture back in your mind. You kind of see where it comes from. And all this, of course, has to do with this electron-electron interactions, because this interaction part, that is what is always makes any treatment, anything that we do, sort of approximate. Because, as I mentioned, the picture we have usually in mind is called that one electron feels some average potential U due to the other electrons. I mean, this U sub L, of course, that's just part of what the electrodes, comes from the electrodes, but this is the part that comes from what it one electron feels due to all the other electrons. And that is really an approximate treatment, which is widely used. I mean, almost everything we'll be doing in this course is based on that. Okay? But it has its limitations, and that's kind of what these few lectures are intended to do, to make you aware of the limitations and give you a feeling for that multi-electron picture in terms of which you can think even when there's strong interactions, even when electrons are strongly interacting. Okay, so the simple picture is, of course, that you have a level and the current that you get depends on this gamma 1, gamma 2 and the levels. Now, in general, as we have discussed, these levels all broaden out, and so you talk in terms of a density of states. So usually, as you know, the equation for current would have an integral over energy. But here I've kind of simplified it just for a single level. So assuming that we are thinking of a situation where, you know, you're like this, every other level is out of the picture, doesn't really matter. There's only one level in the range of interest. And then this would be what the current would look like. And now the thing is that usually, of course, levels come in pairs. So let's say we put in two of them. So one upspin and one downspin. And in this simple picture, all it means is you multiply by kind of two here, because you think that you've got two levels and they both give you current. And you can calculate. But then there is this important thing that you have to worry about is, as current flows, these states are sometimes occupied. So the number of electrons inside is changing. It's different. And depending on where these, how many electrons you happen to have inside, the levels can move. And you have to take into account the fact that the level, instead of being at where you ordinarily assumed it to be, it could move somewhat because of that extra potential. So that's the self-consistent field method, or mean field method, that every electron feels some average potential. And as we have seen in that one of the homeworks, I believe homework 2, that in general you have to do this self-consistently, because till you know the N, you don't quite know the U, but then if you don't know the U, you can't quite calculate the N, etc. Okay. Now, the multi-electron picture, there the way you think is, they've got these two levels, but that corresponds to how many states of the system? Four. Right? Because there's two levels, each one can be either full or empty. And so you usually label them 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1. And the energies of these states are, if you write down the energies, it will be 0, because here there's nothing, that's like a reference. Here I have one electron, epsilon, and when you have two electrons, it's 2 epsilon, if there were no interactions, but then there is an interaction energy, so you add 2 epsilon plus u. And the important thing we discussed, this important concept in this last homework that we've been doing, is that in this picture you think of electrons going in and going out. The equivalent thing in this picture is going up and down. So when an electron comes in, what it does is it takes the system from a 0 electron state onto a 1 electron state. And so the electron that came in must have an energy equal to this difference, you know, for just for conservation of energy. Yes?
Is it u or u sub 0?
Right. Thank you. Yeah. Let me put u sub 0. That's the 1 electron. Right. The single electron charging energy. And that, here the way we are defining it is the interaction energy of a pair of electrons. If you have 2 electrons, the interaction energy between them, whatever that is, right? So, actually, maybe I should not use the same symbol here. So, just thinking what would be the best. I don't want to use, because the connection between what we put here and what we necessarily put here, that's a little more subtle. So, I'm thinking I just want to use something else. So let me call it interactions for the moment, whatever that is. Right? Actually, no, under some simple conditions, it's actually equal to u0, but I don't want to imply that they are the same thing. Because here the way you're thinking is, if I add 1 electron, how much does the energy change of these 1 electron levels? Whereas here what we really put in is that we have 2 electrons, what is their interaction energy? Now, it's not immediately obvious, those two have to be the same thing, right? And in general, it won't be, although in this particular simple case, I think it is, right? Okay. And so, what we discussed is the rate at which it comes in is proportional to this gamma F. F meaning the Fermi function in the contact. Remember, there's no Fermi function well-defined inside the device itself. That's out of equilibrium, no interacting object, no particular Fermi functions. So that is in the contact. Now there's two contacts. So when I really write gamma F, usually it means gamma 1 F1 plus gamma 2 F2. And then coming down is gamma F bar. F bar meaning 1 minus F. That's for this. Again, for these, it is also similar, except that now it is gamma F prime, a different one. Why is it different? Because you see, now you need an electron with this energy. Yeah.
You're saying the rate of the electrons coming out and just getting in. Why don't we include the H bar there? You know, the gamma over the H bar.
It should be included. I'm just not to clutter up this thing, I'm not writing it. You're right. So rate should be, as he says, this divided by h bar. Because gamma over h bar has the dimensions of per second, right? And f is just a dimensionless number. Very, very true, right? So it's really gamma over h bar. I'm just being sloppy here in terms of not writing it, just so you don't clutter it up. That's all. Okay? So same here. They should all have over h bar in there. Because the way I've defined things, gamma has the dimensions of energy. Gamma over h bar is per second. Okay. So, now the point is that going from here to here, you're going to use a different F. That's the important thing. Because now you're really looking for electrons with this energy. And that's different from this one. So, for example, you can easily have a situation where electrons are available with this energy, but there are none available with epsilon plus u interaction. Because the Fermi function out here is almost zero. So it is almost as if you have a kind of level up there. Why? And the thing is that these levels correspond to these differences. So when I write epsilon plus U in interaction, the point is that is not the same as this. And it's very important to keep this distinction clear in mind. This is the energy of that two-electron system. This is the difference between the two-electron system energy and the one-electron system energy. This kind of tells you what energy an electron must come in with in order to make the system go from here to there. And that energy is actually equal to the difference. So whatever appears on the one electron picture usually is energy differences from here, not these levels themselves. It's the differences that matter. Right? This is a very important conceptual point to be clear of in terms of dealing with these two systems. And in this picture, the way you think of it is that, okay, there is a level here at epsilon which corresponds to these transitions, which means as long as there is no electron, that's the energy it takes to put in an electron. Or if there happens to be an electron, when you take it out, that's the energy you get. On the other hand, if an electron is already present, then to add a second electron, that's when you need that much energy. So it is as if the level has floated up for that, etc. This is the whole thing. You need that much energy to get it in. And so when you're trying to work in this picture, the way people try to kind of take into account all these complications is by saying that, okay, the level epsilon floats up by an amount U. And how much does it float up by? Well, it depends on how many electrons are in there. So if there happens to be none in there, then you don't need to float it up at all. It's at epsilon. If there happens to be one electron in there, if the delta N were 1, it would have floated up by so much, etc. So that's how kind of that picture works. You see, but it's an approximate one. It doesn't really cover things right, because most importantly, it doesn't account for this, what's called the self-interaction correction. That is, that the way you have to think is, when one electron comes in, there's two levels there. One electron comes into this level, but as a result, it's the other level that floats up, not that level itself. Because this level, in a way, is still there, because the system is somewhere here. If you wanted to take out that electron, it would still involve only that much energy. It is just that to add the next one, you'd need more energy. So it is as if one level has floated up and one level has kind of stayed there. And the way you rationalize it is by saying, well, you know, the electrons don't interact with itself. So one electron is present there, but that level does not feel anything due to itself, which is why this level stays there. Whereas the other one feels it and floats up. But because it has floated up, it's empty. And because this is empty, this kind of stays there, because it feels the potential due to that one, etc. So to include this into this description would require things that we haven't discussed. And that's what's called the self-interaction correction. That is, people would say that, well, instead of this, let's turn it into something like this, where you have a separate potential for every level. So the ith level feels a potential that only involves delta N in all the levels except the ith level. Because the ith level doesn't feel anything due to the change in the number in that level itself. You see? So that's what you call self-interaction correction. Now, with two levels, it's kind of relatively easy to do this. Even then, it would be approximate if you did that. But with many levels, it's not quite as clear, which is why if you actually did a Google search on self-interaction correction, you'd, I think, come out with hundreds of papers. Lots of people trying all kinds of different things. The thing is, in this world, you see, because as I said, it's very hard to use this one for big things. So this is not what anybody uses. What people use is this one. And then what they argue about is how best to do this, how best to choose this potential, how to choose it better so it would agree with experiment, you know, better. And this is why, of course, comparing with experiments is so important, because almost anything you are doing is approximate. And unless you compare with experiment, you don't know whether you are really capturing the real physics. So one of the first examples of this, if you look in the book, I think I had a picture that showed this comparison of all the different atoms. These are the energy levels of all the atoms in the periodic table. This is on page 63. And the x-axis is basically the atomic number, which means all the different elements of your periodic table. And these are the different energy levels. And you'll see the theory and experiment, they match quite well. But the theory is really based on an approximate picture like this, where you are solving Schrodinger equation, but including a potential due to the average potential due to the other electrons. And how do you have any confidence in this? Well, it's because it matches so well. That's how you know that, well, there must be something right about it. Okay. So what homework 3 then was about was just the idea is to kind of get a feeling for how to calculate current voltage characteristics in this picture. Because most of the time what we'll be doing is this. This is what is generally used. And this picture, that's what I wanted to give you a flavor of. Now, today what I want to talk more about is, yes, please.
How do you know that, that is denoted epsilon? I mean, if you just add the one electron, and another electron falls off the 2 epsilon times your interaction, how do you know that that's the 2 epsilon, you know, falls off?
Oh, in general, it could have been, I made this thing simple by saying that I had these two spin degenerate levels, both of which were epsilon to start with. But what could have happened is, say, you could have had one level epsilon 1 and the other one epsilon 2, for example. Then this would have been epsilon 1 plus epsilon 2 plus U interaction, right? Because epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 then would be the levels that you got without considering any interactions. That is, as if you solve the Schrodinger equation with only a nuclear potential, no interaction things. That would be those epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. And then you add the interaction. That's it. Okay. Now, at equilibrium, now usually we are interested in non-equilibrium problems. And the difference between non-equilibrium and equilibrium is that at equilibrium, there's only one Fermi function. There's only one chemical potential mu, one temperature T. That's it. And that defines the unique Fermi function for the everything, kind of. On the other hand, non-equilibrium means the two contacts are at different temperatures, different chemical potentials, any of those. And that's what we're generally interested in. But if we are in equilibrium, that means it's the same Fermi function, then that leads to an interesting simplification. Because here itself you can see then what happens is all these gammas will cancel out. Firstly, of course, there won't be any current. It's the same Fermi function. But more importantly here, when you look at the number of electrons, for example, this would just become F1 or F2, whichever you like, because those two are equal. It will just cancel all. I'll cancel out. So it's just F1. So this basically tells you that at equilibrium, in this one electron picture, every level is just filled according to the Fermi function. At equilibrium. So if you want to know, well, what's the average number of electrons in there? Just use the Fermi function. You know, and the Fermi function, I've said before, looks something like this. F of x, or let me just write f of some energy E. We have done it, okay, probably, in general. It's kind of up to you whether you want to include the mu here in the definition, or the point is that if you have a chemical potential mu, then the occupation of a level E is given by something like this at equilibrium. That's the Fermi function. Now, the point I wanted to make is that in this interacting picture, in this multi-electron picture, also, there is a special solution for the equilibrium case. Because you see here, in this picture, when it's equilibrium, I don't need to know all these gammas. I don't need to know how easily electrons come in and go out. I mean, apart from the fact that if the gamma is big, it would tend to broaden the levels and all that. That other than that, I don't really need to know the gammas because, you know, the occupation is just F. That's it. And the same is true here, that when I try to calculate the currents, in general, I need to know gamma 1, gamma 2 in detail. But to write down the equilibrium solution, I don't really need to. I could do the usual thing, but the answer I'll get, I could have written down much more simply at equilibrium. And the other point I want to make is that in an interacting system like this, you'll find that at equilibrium, the occupation is not exactly given by the Fermi function. That Fermi function is only works for non-interacting systems, and usually for the contacts, you assume it's just non-interacting dilute gas of electrons. But in here, if there are strong interactions, we'll see it's not exactly the Fermi function. And this is something you have probably seen in 305 or 606. That is, in semiconductor physics, when people calculate the occupation of the donor levels, they use something that's not exactly the Fermi function. There's something a little bit different. Right? And that's because donor levels are localized levels where there are strong interactions. And what we'll do here, you'll see where that comes from, really, in a way. So the basic idea is that at equilibrium, you see, usually gamma F is like gamma 1 F1 plus gamma 2 F2. And this gamma F bar is like gamma 1 F1 bar plus gamma 2 F2 bar. Now, as you might expect, the occupation of these two levels, occupation meaning the probability it will be here and the probability it will be there, is inversely proportional to these rates that we have discussed, because it's like P00 times this equals P01 times that. It's kind of going up and down the same rate. Now, so you expect that the occupation probabilities would be in the ratio of these two things. And of course, the ratio of these two things in general depend on the gamma 1s and gamma 2s. Except that if all Fs were the same, then you see the gamma 1s just cancel out. That ratio is always simply F over F bar. And there is only one, I mean, you could write F1 over F1 bar, you could use F2 over F2 bar, whatever it is. So the ratio of going up to down is always exactly this ratio of F to F bar at equilibrium. So the thing is that the rate at which you go, say, down to up, it's equal to F bar over F or F over F bar. F bar over F. This is the ray. Because you're going down, that's F bar, going up is F. And F bar over F is equal to 1 minus F over F, of course, which is 1 over F minus 1, which is equal to, can you help me how much? So if that's F, it's just the exponential. Right? Where this E is, of course, is exactly this energy difference. Right? Remember, because what Fermi function do I use? I use the Fermi function corresponding to that energy difference always. So always, whenever you have two states in this multi-electron picture, you know, two states like this, one with n plus 1 electrons, and the other with n electrons, whose energy differs by E, so this energy difference is E, then the point is that the rate at which it will come down will always be bigger than the rate at which it goes up by that ratio. Okay? Now, what I can show is that the following solution will automatically work. Yeah, go ahead.
Isn't that the minus sign on the form?
Say this again?
Shouldn't be the minus sign.
Should there be a minus sign in front? Think about it. This is, you know, I just wiped this out actually. It's like 1 over f minus 1. So 1 over f is just this. So I take away 1, that's this. So it's just this. Okay? And that's the down to up. If you had written up to down, it would have been minus. And the thing to remember is that, yeah, if this is a positive quantity, then, yeah, it's a down that is bigger, up is smaller. Now, the solution I wanted to mention, let me just write this here. The general solution is the following. That is the probability of any state, alpha, in the multi-electron picture at equilibrium is given by exponential minus e minus mu n alpha over kT. That's it. So this e is proportional to that actually. And there's a proportionality constant out front which you put in. And that constant is chosen in such a way that all the probabilities add up to 1. So you put a 1 over, it's written as 1 over c. So this is this basic law of equilibrium, actually. That in the multi-electron picture, the probability the system will be in a state alpha is given by this, where this is the energy of the state alpha. This n is the number of electrons in that state alpha. Okay? And what I want to show you is that if you assume that, then you'll automatically have this balance, namely the rate at which it goes up will be equal to the rate at which it comes down. And so this will be a stationary solution. That's the point I'm trying to make. So how do you see that? Help me. So let us say this energy is, so according to this rule then, the probability the system will be here, let's call it say Pn plus 1, and the probability the system will be here is Pn. And the point is that at equilibrium, Pn plus 1 times the downward rate, which is gamma F bar, should be equal to Pn times the upward rate. And that cancels out. And so what must happen then is that Pn over Pn plus 1 should be equal to F bar over F, which is, as we have discussed, e to the power delta E, that's the energy difference between them, minus mu over kT. So what I'm saying is, just based on rates, in order to make sure up and down are equal, it ought to be this way. And what I claim is that this solution will automatically ensure that. Is that right? Because didn't I write this right? Pn plus 1 f bar is Pn f. So, you know, Pn plus 1 f bar is Pn f. Right? No? Okay. And so f bar over f, that e here, that's of course the energy difference, of course, because we are supposed to use the Fermi functions corresponding to that energy difference. So I'll call that delta e. So it's really this. And what I claim is that this solution automatically takes care of that. So that way, I want to convince you that this should work in general. Okay, this will automatically take care of that. Now, do you see that? Let's try. So, according to this, then Pn plus 1 should be equal to 1 over z according to this, that's how I would write it. So my question is Pn divided by Pn plus 1 indeed equal to this? Because if it is, then I'm kind of done. So check this out. When I'm trying to write Pn divided by Pn plus 1, of course, this just cancels out. And then you get exponential En plus 1 minus En, which is the delta E, and then this minus mu, because it's mu n plus 1 and this is mu n, so you cancel, and divided by kT. So what I'm trying to say is that this solution automatically ensures that the ratio between those two things will always be equal to this, which is exactly what you need in order to have this going up and down be the same. Okay. So this is the central result. And this is actually, you see, if you took a course in statistical mechanics, this is like the central result, in a sense that you'd spend about half the course deriving this and the other half applying it. But this is the central thing, essentially, that no matter how complicated a system, in this multi-electron picture, at equilibrium, the probability that the system will be in state alpha is proportional to exponential minus E alpha minus mu n alpha over kT. And then this proportionality constant you figure out so that the P's add up to 1. That's it. Now, what I want to do is quickly apply this to a problem where you have these two levels, upspin and downspin, let's say, but they're strongly interacting, so that what happens is this energy is epsilon. This energy, which is supposed to be this 2 epsilon plus u interaction, is extremely large, you know, like huge. So what that physically means is that this, you have got two levels there. You can put one electron in either level, but there's no way you can put two there. It just takes too much energy. And the question is, what then would be the average number of electrons in there? Because if this interaction were not there, then you would say, well, the average, you know, any one of them is occupied according to the Fermi function, which is e to the power epsilon minus mu over kT plus 1. And if you got 2 in there, sure, multiply it by 2. If you have got 2 levels. Because each level, probability of occupation of each level is so much. You got 2 of them, multiply by 2, that would be the average number. And what we are trying to figure out is, what's the average number of electrons in there if they're so strongly interacting that you can never have 2 electrons in there? And what we'll find is it won't be exactly this, it'll be something else. And that something else, as I said, you have probably seen in the courses on semiconductor devices, where it is that something else that you use when you try to find the occupation of donor levels. That's right? And what I'll be doing is showing you where that comes from in a way. Okay. Okay. So what we have then is a problem like this, where if you have no electrons in there, the energy is 0. If you have 1 electron in there, the energy is epsilon. If you have 2 electrons in there, that's the energy. So if you look at number of electrons, this is 1, this is 0, this is 2. And what we are trying to find is the average number of electrons at equilibrium. So basically, we need to find at equilibrium what is the probability the system will be here? What's the probability system will be there? What's the probability system will be there? And according to this basic law of equilibrium, then, you would write P00, probability it will be in the zeroth state, will be equal to 1 over z times, can you help me with that factor? You know, alpha is the index that tells you all these different states, this, 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 and that. And what we have here is the E alpha and the N alpha. So can you tell me the probability the system will be in 0, 0? This is 0, that's 0. So this exponent is just 1. So it's just 1 over Z. No. What about P 0, 1? E alpha is epsilon, N is 1. So it will be e to the power minus epsilon minus mu over kT. And that's also equal to P10. P10, same story, same epsilon. And P11 in general would have been something like this. Can you help me? Exponent e to the power minus can you help me what I should write here? It's this 2 epsilon plus interaction energy. And then minus 2 mu, that's the thing, right? Not just mu, but 2 mu, because it's a state with 2 electrons in it. So strictly speaking, this. Okay. Yeah.
Why is it 2 epsilon plus u interaction? I thought you said the Pauli function is a function of the energy difference.
Right. So this is where we have to be very clear. That whenever we are working with Fermi functions, that's in this one electron picture. So we are talking about, okay, where is this energy level, what is the occupation of that level, etc. Whereas, whatever I'm doing here, and this law of equilibrium, it really applies only in the multi-electron picture. So here, when I'm talking of energies, it's the energies of the multi-electron system. So this picture is all... This expression, it's not the Fermi function really. I mean, you can get the Fermi function from it, but that requires some derivative. This is not the Fermi function, because Fermi function is only applies to, gives you the occupation of levels in the one electron picture when electrons are non-interacting, actually. Very special situation. Whereas this, as I said, is the general law of equilibrium in statistical mechanics. Doesn't matter how complicated the system, how interacting, whether it's a superconductor or not, whether it's whatever it may be, or a magnet, whatever it could be, very complicated system. But that still holds. This is like the sum and substance of essential all of equilibrium statistical mechanics. This is the central law. Okay? This is not the Fermi function. That's the point I'm making. Whereas Fermi function is a very special thing. Okay, so what we are now trying to do is apply this very general principle of statistical mechanics to a relatively simple problem, namely where you have got two levels, but it's a little more complicated than the simplest problem in the sense they're interacting. The simplest problem would have been if I had dropped this interaction totally. But this is a case where there is a strong interaction, and this is where... To simplify the algebra a little bit, and the result that you usually see in semiconductor physics for donor levels, that really corresponds to the case where this is extremely large. I mean, it's essentially infinity. So what that means is, you can set this equal to 0. Don't have to worry about this at all. That's what it means. In practice, if this was really not infinity but something you need to worry about, then you'd have to include this in the discussion. But for the moment, let's just drop this. That kind of simplifies the algebra. So this is what we have then. Now what we need to do is go ahead and try to find the average number of electrons. That's what you're now trying to do. What we have is the occupation of 0,0 state, 0,1 state, and 1,0 states. Now, how do we figure out the occupation of electrons? So, drop this. The point is that all three of them must add up to 1. So, and I need to make use of that in order to find that constant. You say, I don't quite have that constant. That's the thing. So, the way you do it is you say that 1 over z, that's P00, plus 1 over z exponential this quantity, so let me call it e to the power minus x, where I give that a name. So x is epsilon minus mu over kt. I just give that a name. Plus e to the power minus x is equal to 1. Because this is P00, the first term, 1 over z e to the power minus x, that's P01. And P10, same thing. So, what is z? One divided by right. Say this again. Thank you. Good. Z is 1 plus 2 e to the power minus x. Okay? Perfect. Okay. Now, remember, what we are trying to do is find the average number of electrons, n. So, average number of electrons is given by P01 times 1 plus P10 times 1 plus P00 times 0, right? Because if it is in 0,1 state, you got 1 electron. If it's in 1,0 state, you got 1 electron. If it's here, you got 0 electrons. So basically, number of electrons is P01 plus P10, which is equal to, this is e to the power minus x, can you help me? Divided by z, and z is what we have found already, which you could write as 2 divided by, sorry, or rather, does that look right? It's usually 1 plus half e to the power x. Does that look right? Or it's like 1 divided by this, right? 1 divided by 1 plus. And this is what you'd usually see in semiconductor devices, that when you're trying to find the average number of average number of electrons in a donor level, which has a degeneracy of 2, you'd use this. If the degeneracy was g in general, then instead of 2, you'd have got a g there. That's the general formula you often see. But note that this is not the usual Fermi function, because the usual Fermi function would have been 2 times 1 over 1 plus e to the power x. Now, the usual Fermi function wouldn't have this in there. You see, and the only reason we got this is because it's this interactions. See? And the point I wanted to make is that this, though, is a general formula that will give you, will cover everything. This is a general one. For example, if you had applied this formula to just 2 levels, supposing you have a by two levels, I mean, supposing you have just one level in the one electron picture, which can either be empty or full. So it's, you're just talking of P0 and P1. Then you can try it out, apply this, and find the average number of electrons, you'd get the Fermi function. So in that sense, you see the Fermi function is just a special case of this general thing. Apply it to two levels which are interacting, which are strongly interacting, and you find the average number to be that. Apply it to four levels which are very strongly interacting, so that you can only have one electron in there at a time. Instead of two, you'll come out with four over there. That's it. Apply it to G levels, you'd have a G there. So the point is, this is the general principle there. Now, one version of this that you often see is the following, that what if KT were tending to zero? So you are doing something at low temperatures. And what I claim is that in that case, the solution is something like this, that P alpha is equal to 1 for state with minimum E alpha minus mu n alpha. So whatever state happens to have the minimum value of this, that's the state the system will go into. And the P alpha will be zero for everything else. Now this is not quite obvious, so let me just explain where the, although it's not a new rule I'm saying, it actually follows from here. In the sense, if you program this into a computer, that's what you'd have got if you'd just done this. But I want to explain where that comes from. So it works something like this. Let's say we take two levels, and E alpha minus mu n alpha for one of those levels, let's say happens to be 50, and the other one is 100. That's it. Then what I'm saying is, at low temperatures, in fact, let's make this E alpha minus mu n alpha over KT. So let us say this quantity for one of the levels happens to be 50, the other happens to be 100. And what I claim is that that the system will be in the state with the minimum value. So the probability of being here would be approximately 1. Probability of being here will be approximately 0. Question is, how do you see that? Well, if we just apply this formula, then you see what you'd have got is that the probability of being here would be something like e to the power minus 50 divided by z, whereas the probability of being here would be e to the power minus 100 divided by z, right? Because according to this rule. And the point is, when you first look at it, it looks puzzling because you say, well, this is also 0, that's also almost 0. Even after all, e to the power minus 50, I mean, you can put it on your calculator, it will come out to be a minuscule number. That's also minuscule. But the point is, of course, both can be zero. All probabilities must add up to one. That's the thing about this picture. You can't really have a occupation of zero. So what that means is, when you find z, you'll find that z is actually e to the power minus 50 plus e to the power minus 100. So that when I add the two, I get one. So when you actually calculate z to make sure that the two add up to 1, you'll find it's equal to that. And now you see the argument that if you look here, these are both very small things, but then this is a whole lot smaller than that. So in the denominator, you can drop that. So what that means is the occupation probability of this one is almost 1, like I said, and the occupation of this one is extremely small, almost 0. That's the thing. So the bottom line is that when KT is so small that all these exponents happen to be large numbers, you know, 100, 1,000, 10,000, whatever it is, the system will generally go to the state with the smallest value of that exponent. And so that's the form often you see, which says that the law of statistical mechanics is that at low temperatures, the system will go to the state with the lowest value of E minus mu n. Whereas, in general, though, this is what I call the general law of equilibrium.